on Christ.
If Christ, on Christ, has salvation worth the great sacrifice, great voluntary sacrifice, should not you think your own salvation worth the light worth the high light of learning and meditation?
Before our minds as one whom we may contemplate, worship, and address, when we rise up, we light up, when we eat, when we are at home and abroad, and we are working,
or walking,
or when we are alone,
and
again when we are alone.
Remember the truth. most cruel.
This was most
and
cruel.
Most cowardly and most uncowardly.
That was Current 93 with To Feed the Moon. Thanks for tuning in to Active Listening. You can tune in every Sunday night at 9:38 Eastern, 6:38 Pacific, etc. on numbers.fm, or you can check out playlist MP3s of past episodes at badtasterlife.com. That's badtaste4life.com. This is Dahlia signing off.
An Armenian reformer in Khrushchev's Kremlin. And just to start out, for any listeners who, we hear Mikoyan's name and we might know some things about him, but I would imagine most people who know fairly amount about Soviet history, like myself, don't really know much about him. So why don't you tell us who he was and why you decided to write a book about him?
So Anastas Mikoyan is a famous Soviet statesman of Armenian origin who was born in the northern Lori region of Armenia to a poor Armenian family. His father was a carpenter. One of his siblings, his brother, was the inventor, or co-inventor, really, of the famous MiG fighter, right? I mean, he was with Gurievich and this MiG design bureau and all this. And from his youth in Sana'in, he went to the Armenian seminary. Actually, first he went to the Nersessian school in Tiflis, Armenian school in Tiflis. Then he went to the Gevorgyan Armenian Seminary in Ashmiadzin. And it was there that he became a radical. He didn't pursue a life in the church. He went and instead pursued a career in revolution. And eventually he became involved with the Russian Revolution in Baku. He was involved with the Baku Commune and Stepan Shamian, right? And then after the revolution in Baku and really the success of the Bolsheviks in the Russian Civil War, Mikoyan he took various positions. He was, for a while, he was in Nizhny Novgorod. He was doing party work there. Then he also was the head of the North Caucasus region, right? So there's a lot of interesting history there, which I discuss in my book.
Is this where he hooks up with the Stalin group?
Yeah, actually, that actually already begins in the 20s. Stalin actually sees some potential in Mikoyan. He kind of brings Mikoyan under his wings. So actually, Mikoyan joins, or actually, he's kind of initially part of Stalin's inner circle, right? And that's actually how we get to know him. Like, when we get to the 30s, he becomes famously the Minister of Trade. He goes to the United States in the 1930s, begins to look at the innovations there with the food, with the Eskimo pies, right? As we know in Russia today, in the post-Soviet countries today, like a good cutlet of meat is known as Mikoyan. And it kind of goes on from there. There have even been books written about this. It's very famous. And this is the first association people in the post-Soviet space actually have with Mikoyan, right? Then Mikoyan also was in charge of supply during the Great Patriotic War. After that, then he was involved in de-Stalinization in the 1950s. And then after that, he was also involved with international diplomacy, very famously. So as we know, the Cuban Missile Crisis, also Hungary, he actually took a dissenting position on the use of Soviet troops in Hungary. So that's kind of his whole portfolio. I mean, this is really somebody who, as the Russians say, is from, you know, Ilyich to Ilyich, from Ilyich Lenin to Ilyich Brezhnev, and all the leaders in between, most famously Stalin and Khrushchev. Those are the main ones that Mikoyan, the main leaders that Mikoyan was serving under. So anyway, that's kind of a him in a nutshell. Why was I drawn to Mikoyan? What drew me to Mikoyan? Well, in general, first, John, you have to think of it like this. I was always interested in the history of Soviet Armenia. And that's because of my family background. So my father is an Armenian from Romania. He grew up under, you know, communism in Romania, under state socialism in Romania. And his family was allowed to leave Romania because his parents had non-SEN passports. So what happened was, as a result of the Armenian genocide in 1915, a lot of Armenians got these, you know, kind of non-SEN passports that were named for this Norwegian humanitarian, Friedrich Nansen. And long story short, they first went to Lebanon, then they went to Queens, New York, and then they ended up in Cleveland, Ohio. And so, you know, eventually from that whole history, I became very fascinated with it. In high school years, I was really interested in the connection between Armenians and communism. And the whole Soviet Armenian experience was just so fascinating to me. I was really into Jack Reed's 10 Days That Shook the World, The Russian Revolution. And so from there, I got into Soviet Armenia, but Mikoyan was a topic. You know. And anyway, so what ended up happening is I really got into this history of Soviet Armenia during Perestroika, but I wanted to go back even further and see this whole history of the thaw in Soviet Armenia.
Another thing too, like the history of these figures, like around Stalin in particular, right? We have a lot of work about Stalin personally. But we actually don't have a lot of work on what I would argue is just as important, which is the small group of people around him.
Absolutely. I mean, well, we have a few kind of, but it's like popular history, right?
Yeah.
Like Montefiore, right? Or even Roy Medvedev. I mean, it's not really, you know.
I mean, Sheila Fitzpatrick's book on Stalin's team is.
That's the best one. I use that extensively in my book. She's the best.
Yeah.
She's absolutely. I mean, I have to say that, throwing that out there right now.
And so I've come to understand, to really understand the way Stalinism worked, you have to look at these people, because they're the ones who are being sent, and we'll get to that in a bit around the terror, but they're being sent to localities to essentially bust heads and to put whatever they decided Moscow to work on the ground, or to cleanse out the people who aren't doing the right work on the ground, or for whatever reason. And especially if we consider the fact how personalized Stalin power around in the Stalin circle was, the fact that, you know, yeah, he was the Minister of Trade and that was his main portfolio, but these guys could hold several jobs.
Absolutely, could hold several jobs at once. But Mikoyan, for me, it was interesting because I was interested in his role in de-Stalinization, because he gave a speech in Yerevan in 1954, which I'll talk about later in this podcast, where he called for the rehabilitation of Chavez. But there was also, Sean, a history of Mikoyan and his role in de-Stalinization in the center. So I wanted to try and connect these two, what was going on in Yerevan, what was going on in Moscow. And I was really fascinated in this history. And actually, it was Stephen F. Cohen, who wrote the biography of Bukharin, who encouraged me. He said, you should write your PhD dissertation on Mikoyan.
Well, let's go into the book itself. You know, the book starts in Yerevan in 1937, and Mikoyan is sent to Armenia to do some pretty unsafe, to supervise but also implement some pretty unsavory things. It's a dramatic and bloody story, and you tell it with lots of detail. What was his role in this period, this intervention into Armenian politics during the terror? And more importantly, since the book is about post-Stalin period, how did that impact him? How did that shape him?
Well, let me kind of work backwards and answer the last question first, because that's going to allow us to keep this organized. The first thing is that his role in Stalinist state violence, as I write in the book, that left him with kind of a sense of guilt, you know, that for his role in this, his own complicity in this. That's number one. Number two, the other element is that this intervention that he was involved with in September 1937 in Yerevan, it was a moment, Sean, if you can believe, where for about a month, the entire political and security apparatus of Armenia was run by Moscow directly. They sent, initially, Stalin didn't even send Mikoyan there initially. He sent Malenkov there with Malenkov's buddies, Dmitry Sukhanov and Vladimir Donskoy and all these other characters, and also an NKVD brigade led by Mikhail Litvin, who was a deputy of Yuzhov in the NKVD. And basically, they were running the show in Yerevan directly for a period of about a month. So this was to Mikoyan. I mean, it was to him, in his view, he was perceiving it as this kind of, again, how the local self-governance of the republics was being completely violated in Stalin's time. Stalin had no regard for this. Now, Mikoyan came about 1 week after Malenkov and Litvin arrived in Yerevan. And what was interesting is that there's a story in all Stalin's men. We mentioned this book by Roy Medvedev, right? Where basically there was this anecdote supposedly where Stalin used the history of the Baku Commissars to threaten Mikoyan. Well, one of the documents we have from the FSB archives from Memorial actually shows that Stalin was sending Mikoyan on the exact same date of the execution of the 26 Baku Commissars. So there's some interesting kind of connections there. But Mikoyan's main role was to change political leadership. They agreed to bring in this guy, Arutinov, who was an Armenian from Tel Aviv, Georgia, who actually did not speak Armenian. He only spoke Russian. But they made him the first secretary of Armenia. Mikoyan himself also signed off on or consented to an increase in repressions in Armenia that, you know, Malenkov and Litvin, you know, wanted. Mikoyan also was writing in his memoirs that he had to sign a list of 300 names for arrest. But most likely, I conclude in my research, that this most likely was a list for exile, because the one man who he tried to save from that list, his old revolutionary comrade, Danush Shevardnadze, was eventually sent to the Gulag, and he died in 1941 while in prison. And actually, what's interesting about this is you get the sense how deep the role of Stalin is, Sean. Stalin's fingerprint, he's constantly talking to Malenkov. We have the documents from Memorial, and also the general kind of disregard for the rule of law. Like, Stalin is telling Malenkov, look, you know what? Molotov and I don't trust Amatuni, who was the first secretary of Armenia, but we think that he's a hidden Trotskyite, so you find evidence on him. But also something else that's really interesting about this, which is the backstory of the repressions and the terror in Armenia, the purges in Armenia before this specific episode, which was that they really began in July 1936 when Lavrenti Beria shot Agassi Khanjian, the Armenian first secretary, and brought in Amatuni and Hachik Mogdusi to lead the repressions in Armenia, to really kind of completely decimate the entire Armenian intellectual and political elite at the time. And actually, Stalin came in because he intervened directly, because Amatuni and Mogdusi, they went a bit too far, and they killed this prominent Armenian old Bolshevik, Sahakter Gabrielian. He was pushed, or he jumped from the third floor window of the Armenian NKVD building. I mean, this is an interesting story. But the most interesting thing about this, Sean, is how these were Beria's cronies. And when Malenkov is on his way to Yerevan, he stops for about a day in Tiflis and consults with Beria on the repressions. So he's almost getting Beria's okay to go after his minions. And Beria even personally attends the interrogation of Ammatuni. So this was almost like a test, not only of Mikoyan's loyalty, which is what, like Sheila Fitzpatrick writes about that. A lot of people, you know, say, well, Stalin sent Mikoyan there to test his loyalty. Malenkov already was a seasoned veteran of these interventions.
He was. If you're selling Malenkov or somebody like Kaganovich, they're sold. Their loyalty is secured, or right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Oh, 100%. As you know, Sheila Fitzpatrick writes in her book, a fantastic book, that actually Mikoyan, this was the only time he was sent out in the provinces because Stalin distrusted him. He thought he was too lenient toward the repressed, and he wanted to really kind of, you know, test his loyalty. But also it was a test, I would argue, of Beria's loyalty, because it's his cronies who are being sacrificed. So this was almost like, you know, a test in advance of Beria being promoted to the All-Union NKVD, to be the head of the All-Union NKVD. So it's a very interesting episode, but it leaves Mikoyan, going back to your main question, it leaves Mikoyan, number one, with a sense of guilt. And it leaves him also with a sense of the fact that the local self-governance of the national republics is non-existent, that the center has complete authority over them.
It's really revealing, and this is, again, why I think biographies, or at least studies on these type of guys like Mikoyan and Kaganovich and Malenkov, etc., because you can see, at least the way you present it, one of the goals to send Mikoyan there, as you said, is to get him complicit. It's collective responsibility. And you have to get your hands dirty because we're all getting our hands dirty.
Yeah. Well, Stalin, I mean, also, you know what's fascinating is just like the mentality of Stalin, because like they had one time, there's a note that Ammatuni sends to Stalin, and I think it's like June 1937, where he's basically saying, look how many people we've arrested and look how many Trotskyists we've uncovered and everything like that. But we still have to uncover more. And what's interesting is he's complaining to Stalin about Pravda's coverage of events in Armenia and this journalist Kotliarov. And what's so interesting is that when Stalin does his intervention and he sends Malenkov to Yerevan and everything, who does he send as the Pravda correspondent to Yerevan? He sends Kotliarov. So Stalin, he was that detail-oriented. Right? He knew how to stick it to people. I mean, it's a fascinating history, and I'm glad I could uncover it. And yeah.
Well, you know, as famously, Stalin dies in March 1953, and very quickly things begin to fracture and unravel amongst the top leadership. And more importantly for your story, in 1954, Mikoyan finds himself again in Yerevan, and he gives a really important speech on nationality policy. Tell us a bit about this speech. You know, what was its main gist? Why did he give it? And how really this sets the groundwork for what he's going to try to do moving forward?
This speech that he gives in Yerevan in March 11th, 1954. Well, first of all, I should set some context, because as I mentioned at the beginning of chapter two, he arrives in Yerevan on March 10th, 1954 at the Stalin statue. So in the Victory Park in Yerevan, where we now have Mother Armenia, there used to be a huge statue of Yosif Vissarionovich overlooking the whole scene. And Mikoyan began his trip there, but the speech that he gave the next day on March 11th set the stage, Sean, for the eventual removal of that Stalin statue. Anyway, so in the speech, Mikoyan calls for the republication of these national Armenian writers, Rafael Pakanyan and Rafi, you know, I mean, going back to the old Armenian national revolutionary movement in the Russian Empire in the 19th century, which was both nationalist and actually socialist. It had strong nationalist and socialist elements, like a lot of these national movements, kind of like the Jewish Bund, right? Also, Mikoyan is calling for the preservation of the and revival of the memory of the Armenian Soviet leader, Alexander Myasnikan, who, you know, rebuilt Armenia during this period of NEP in the 1920s. And finally, most crucially, for the first time in 17 years, Mikoyan calls for the rehabilitation of the poet Yegashe Charents. She's like the Armenian Mayakovsky, to give our listeners an idea. And the room explodes in applause. It's a huge moment, right? But all of these names, and especially because it's connected directly to this whole process of rehabilitations and de-Stalinization, this entire speech is framed in this idea that we not only need to reject national chauvinism, but that we need to reject the idea of national nihilism, the idea of indifference to nationalities, and allow nationalities to kind of express themselves a little bit more. Now, there had been earlier, I just want to, you know, emphasize that there had been a year before already, both Beria and Khrushchev were playing with the national question a little bit to kind of curry favor with the Baltics or with Georgia or Western Ukraine or Belarus and all this. But there was no kind of programmatic idea. There was no structure for a kind of a philosophy, a guiding philosophy for how should we approach the national question. And Mikoyan kind of sets the tone with this kind of balanced idea that would balance in a greater room for national expression with at the same time controls to make sure it does not veer into anti-Soviet, you know, chauvinism.
This is like this dance, because I'm doing lots of research on the American Party around race, and they are doing the same dance where you can't ignore it. You can't ignore nationalist feelings or racism, but you can't let it go too far. And the challenge is, how do you keep it within acceptable parameters of,
Let me also throw out something else for you, Sean. This is just me kind of just, you know, thinking about this, but I wonder to what extent the Cold War influenced all this, because, you know, if you're trying to curry favor with different parts of the world and show them how just you are and to show that your ideals align with your actual policies, domestic policies, we know about that, you know, certainly with the case of the United States and civil rights, but it could also be applied to the Soviet Union.
Yeah, certainly. And it did. They did with, I mean, making Tashkent a kind of center of art, cultural outreach to Asia. Didn't Baku play a similar role to the Caucasian region, but also to the Turkic, you know, Persia?
Especially going back to those early years, right? I mean, that was kind of seen as like a beacon. It could be focused. It could be used as like a beacon to the East, right? Even in the case of Armenia, as I detail a little bit, the idea of being a beacon for the Armenian diaspora, right? Especially in the Middle East. But the example you cite of Central Asia is fantastic. I mean, we have this, we have a lot of great newer research on that in recent years. But in any case, about this speech of Mikoyan, what was so striking to me is how this whole structure was so evocative of the nationality platform of the third party program. And so that actually led me to go into GARF and to look at what was Mikoyan's position on the third party program. And I found actually that he was pushing back against this idea of Slyanye. He was pushing back against this idea of a merger of nations.
Or what we would call assimilation.
Assimilation. And he was saying instead of that, we should have a Sblizhenie. We should have this idea of rapprochement of nations. So this is all kind of coming together in this period where, like you say, also Central Asia. I mean, Masha Kirasirova has done really good work on that, you know, specific topic. It's also the period of the kind of the Latvian national communists, the Ukrainian 60s generation, right? Bill Riche can tell you a little bit more about that. But anyways, this is the period, this is the context, and Mikoyan's speech in many ways sets the tone for that and also helps in many ways enable this process of de-Stalinization in the center. So in some cases, it's kind of like a platform to test policies that might be implemented. Because actually, 1 week after Mikoyan gives a speech, Sean, what I found was that there's a rehabilitation commission in Mikoyan's name that already is devoted to rehabilitating victims of the repressions in Armenia in the 1950s. It's a fascinating history. This whole history of rehabilitations is fascinating.
You know, it's really significant. You know, he's Armenian. He gives this speech in Armenia, specifically about Armenian cultural figures. It's playing so many different roles, as you mentioned. It also is very common in the communist period for leaders to throw something out when they're outside of Moscow and see where it lands and how it comes back around through Moscow as a policy. You know, the Bolshevik Party, especially the leadership that coalesces around Stalin in the 1930s, is so fascinating on the ethnic issue of it. Of course, Stalin Georgian, or Orjonikidze Georgian, Mikoyan Armenian. You have Jews like Kaganovich, you have Russians. It's a very interesting, like, around the ethnic policy. For someone like Mikoyan, what does being Armenian mean to him? Do you have a sense of how he understood himself as Armenian and how important that was?
So, absolutely. So there was a great, and I use this concept, which was articulated by this German historian, Michael Lehmann, this idea of the apricot socialism. Right, that you are both Soviet and national at the same time, that those identities can be mutually, they can be complementary, right? That they can intersect with each other. And so Michael Lehmann wrote this article for the Slavic Review in 2015, I believe it was published, where she was writing about the 1965 demonstrations in Yerevan, which enabled this process of the recognition of the Armenian genocide by the USSR, the formulation of this idea of a dual identity that is both Soviet and national at the same time. And this is the idea, again, that the apricot is this idea of the national and the socialism part. Obviously, this is the Soviet part. But Mikoyan fused these two together in his worldview, in his ideology. He saw that the Soviet Union was the best protector for Armenia. He really valued Armenian statehood in the Soviet context. It's actually quite interesting because when you talk about national policy and nationality issues, it was Mikoyan's mentor, Stepan Shamian from the Baku Commune, who articulated at the first All-Caucasus Congress of the Bolshevik Party in October 1917 that what we should do is have, like, you know, self-governing, three self-governing regions in the South Caucasus, in Transcaucasia. That is, a region for the Georgians, a region for the Armenians, and a region for the Muslims, the Azerbaijanis. And so Mikoyan highly valued this concept of Armenian statehood within the Soviet context. At the same time, this was somebody who was a Marxist, somebody who believed in the Marxist class analysis. So it's not as if he was like a hidden Armenian nationalist or something like that. He just fused together the Armenian national interests with Marxism, right? So, I mean, what it meant to be Armenian to him, it was that he was, I guess you could say, something like a national communist. He blended this element of Armenian with being a Marxist at the same time. He saw this as complementary.
And what would be going too far for him? So, like, you set up these two poles, right? You can't be a national nihilist, i.e. you can't ignore that national sentiment is very strong and many people identify themselves with their culture and their ethnicity. But on the other hand, you can't become a chauvinist, which is, what does that mean? I guess one can say the way you put across his views is more on the, okay, we can't ignore this is what we should do. But for him, what did it mean to become a chauvinist?
A chauvinist would be somebody who would be advocating policies like, if we fast forward to the dissolution of the Soviet Union, somebody like Vyadgam Sakordia, who would say, Georgia for Georgians, right? That we should not pay attention even to the smaller nationalities within our borders, and that we are so much better than you. And this is what I mean by chauvinism, this idea that your nation, this concept that your nation is superior to the other nations, and that nation's interests, you know, trump all else, that they don't see any kind of loyalty or any kind of, you know, connection with the Soviet project. This idea that they would divorce themselves from the Soviet project and also, yeah, separatism, and divorce themselves also from this idea of the Eurasian space, this idea of the space of the former Russian Empire. So that's what would be going too far for Mikoyan, certainly. He would not accept something like this, where, you know, you would have that. And actually, he was already beginning to see things like this when you had to deal with the issue of Nagorno-Karabakh, because Azerbaijan was being accused by the Karabakh Armenians of discriminating against them. Krista Goff has written a great monograph, Nested Nationalism, about the fate of non-titular nationalities in Soviet Azerbaijan, specifically the Lezgins and the Talysh, right? Mikoyan could see in that kind of a case that the chauvinism was creeping in under maybe the guise of nationality policy. But Mikoyan pushed back against this by emphasizing ideas such as this Druzhba Narodov, which originated from Stalin, actually. But Mikoyan invoked it in kind of a way that, you know, Josip Broz Tito invoked this idea of brotherhood and unity in Yugoslavia. And he would cite the example, Sean, of the 26 Baku commissars and how they, all the commissars came from different national backgrounds and how they all worked together for the common cause of revolution, and how in that way it could be almost like analogous to, in the present day being the 1950s, the thaw era of the Soviet Union, that we would all be working together for the development, common development of the Soviet state.
So he plays a really important role as one of Khrushchev's lieutenants during the thaw, during de-Stalinization. What's some of the things he did? What did he advocate for? Or how did he imagine, let's in a bigger sense, to a post-Stalinist Soviet Union?
Well, one of the big things that he really went out for, first of all, was the rehabilitation of political prisoners. Because as we know, in 1953, Beria does this general amnesty of prisoners, but it's not really, there's no distinction made between What is a general prisoner and what is a political prisoner? And we get into more of that nitty-gritty once Khrushchev, as Khrushchev, is emerging as the main leader, right? And Mikoyan plays a big role in this, not only in the context of Armenia, although that's a big, you know, element too. I mentioned about Agassi Khanjian. Mikoyan, after he gave his speech, Khanjian's mother appealed to Mikoyan to have her son rehabilitated, right? Danush Shavardian, his son, Sergei, appealed to Mikoyan to rehabilitate his parents, and so on and so forth, right? But Mikoyan was also involved with, you know, these gulag returnees who were devoted to the party completely, who began to act as advisors to him and Khrushchev on the de-Stalinization process. So Olga Shatunovskaya, who was the secretary of Stepan Shamian, and Alexei Snegov, right, another party, you know, leader, who is a close associate of Mikoyan and also Khrushchev, that he knew them both, that they came to inform Mikoyan and Khrushchev about all the horrors of the gulag. Now, of course, Mikoyan and Khrushchev obviously knew about the repressions. They knew about what was going on, but they didn't really know completely the nitty-gritty day-to-day life of what it meant to be a prisoner in the gulag. And so this is what Shatunovskaya and Snegov were, you know, informing Khrushchev and Mikoyan about. And Snegov famously told Khrushchev that if you do not dethrone Stalin at the upcoming Congress, which is the 20th Party Congress in February 1956, then you will go down in history as being seen as complicit in his crimes. And so in any case, the role of the return and rehabilitation of political prisoners and so on and so forth. But the other was the rehabilitation of whole nationalities. So as we know, during the Second World War, entire national groups in the North Caucasus in particular were deported by Stalin and Beria to Central Asia. The Chechens, the Ingush, the Karachai, all these different nationalities, they were all forced to go to Central Asia. And Mikoyan, who actually had, he was the first secretary of the North Caucasus during NEP. And so he knew, actually, he was involved really in creating, or I mean, really establishing Chechnya as an autonomous oblast, because before it was all the mountain Gorskaya ASSR. It was the mountain autonomous republic, and it gradually was broken up into several, you know, autonomous regions that now comprise today the North Caucasus in Russia. So Mikoyan actually knew many of the local leaders in the North Caucasus. He knew the local cultures, and he felt personally responsible to these people. He was the only person who dissented on the deportations of the Chechens in during the war, although it was on the basis that it would harm the USSR's international reputation. But he was the first person actually who was bringing this issue up. So in the discussions over the what should be discussed at the 20th Party Congress in the secret speech, Mikoyan is actually raising the issue of Stalin's, as he calls them, violations of the nationality policy. And by this, he's referring to these deportations of these nationalities from the North Caucasus. So anyway, there's that whole process of bringing them back, which in many cases also, it's not necessarily easy, but he's helping bringing them back. He even meets, by the way, I should mention, with this Chechen English delegation in the Kremlin, right? When Khrushchev is you know, showing, you know, Mr. Tito of Yugoslavia all around Soviet Union, that now Mikoyan uses the opportunity to kind of begin this whole process of restoration, of bringing these people back and restoring their autonomous republics. Although a big part was also played on the ground by the people themselves. They came out of back automatically. And then also you have to think this whole, you know, formulating on the nationality issue, this formulation of this idea of rejecting the merger of nations, replacing Slyania with Splyzhenia, the idea of our new focus is not to force a merger of nationalities, but to have like a live and let live policy that really defines really the whole entire history of the late Soviet Union.
Yeah. Was he a patron of the Caucasus region in general in terms of his political network, his clients? Are they mostly based in the Caucasus or South Caucasus in Armenia in particular?
All these Soviet leaders had patronage networks. And his major patronage network was in Armenia. And he had extensive ties, as I found out. And actually, it was interesting because, you know, Sean, I really, going into this research, I thought Mikoyan, the most he was involved with in Armenian affairs was this whole process of rehabilitations. But I didn't think he was so deeply involved in helping Armenia realize these infrastructure projects, advising them on how to get something passed, to get funds from the Soviet central government, right? We talk about the ARPAS of Ankonal and all that. But Mikoyan had extensive ties to these local elites in Soviet Armenia, these local party officials. And even that's the other source I use, were actually these memoirs in the Armenian language. There's this one memoir by Yegashe Asatryan, who writes an entire chapter on Mikoyan's activities for Armenia. And also Anton Kochinyan, who was also the first secretary of Armenia from 1966 to 1974, has a whole chapter on Mikoyan's activities. But in addition, if you go to GARF, if you go to the Russian archives, you actually find that there is a whole bunch of material that actually reflects what these guys are saying in their Armenian language memoirs. So it's almost like, you know, the relationship between Khrushchev and Ukraine.
I mean, all of these, Stalin had this with Georgia. They all had this. This was the way politics was. It was patron-client networks. How is he regarded in Armenia today?
Armenia today, the reputation of Mikoyan is actually divided, because there are some people who focus. There was this effort to make a statue to Mikoyan in 2014. There are some people who were opposed to the statue on the grounds that Mikoyan was complicit in the Stalinist repressions in the 1930s. Then there was another group saying, well, you know, Mikoyan, he was involved with, you know, international diplomacy, the Cuban Missile Crisis, diffusing that, right, negotiating with Fidel Castro and all this. And what was interesting to me is nobody in that debate was talking about de-Stalinization. It's an entire history that's extraordinarily underexplored, Sean. And that's what, that was another thing that actually kind of contributed, it fueled my interest even more so in this whole episode, because I thought, not only am I interested in the thaw in Armenia, not only am I interested in this connection between the Moscow and the republics, but I also was interested in delving into this history that clearly there was a thread there to pull. And nobody was investigating it. Nobody knew anything about it. And I thought, well, you know, that's the most interesting thing. If nobody knows anything about it, you pull that thread. You see where it goes. There is the moment, a kind of a split Mikoyan's memory in Armenia, although I would say probably in the overall analysis, it's probably more positive. That's my impression.
Yeah. What kind of person was he? What, like, in your, you know, you do research on an individual like this, and you learn how, you know, he did about things, how people regarded him. In thinking about the type of person he was, do you have a sense of that?
I do, because one thing actually about Mikoyan that a lot of people assume is that Mikoyan, well, because he survived for so long, going from Lenin to Stalin to Khrushchev to Brezhnev, people think, oh, you know, this is somebody who was like, he could blow with the wind, that kind of thing. He was no principles or something like that. But one thing I find, actually, what I found in this research is actually he did have principles. He believed in this idea of kind of turning the Soviet Union into kind of, I guess you could say, a socialist democracy, right? The most fascinating chapter, Sean, is chapter 6, because I talk about this unrealized Khrushchev's constitutional reform in the 1960s, where Khrushchev actually envisioned this idea of providing the people, the Soviet people, with more direct control over their own affairs. So actually, this was a very radical reform in the 1960s. And the idea was, according to Khrushchev, that every cook should control her own state, that we should realize socialist democracy, right? This actually was derived from Otto Kucinin's idea of the all-people's state. And actually, this is a larger theme of the thaw in general, that now the focus is more on the people than anything else, right? You know, the focus on housing, consumer goods, right? Khrushchevki, all this and that. And the idea was to actually translate this into political terms. And Khrushchev, in his own words, there were two main reasons for this. Number one, it was the issue with President Kennedy. He didn't like that Kennedy was criticizing him that, you know, you guys don't have real democracy in the Soviet Union. And Khrushchev said, well, we will show you. And then the other thing was to shake up the bureaucracy, which was constantly a thorn in Khrushchev's side. Khrushchev, in this constitutional reform, appointed Mikoyan to be the head of the subcommittee on nationality policy and national state construction. And the idea here was Mikoyan was advocating in this subcommittee to devolve substantial powers from Moscow to the Union republics and to even autonomous entities. So this was an extraordinary reform that nobody knows anything about. And it was basically Mikoyan's vision was that this Soviet Union should be an equal union of republics. Now, How does that relate to him personally? This is somebody who had convictions, somebody who really believed in de-Stalinization. That's why when there was the attempted coup against Khrushchev in 1957, right? When we talk about the anti-party group, right? Malenkov, Molotov, Kaganovich, they basically, the idea to attempt to overthrow Khrushchev, that Mikoyan supported Khrushchev at the moment because of his position on de-Stalinization. So Mikoyan actually believed in this idea of de-Stalinization, right? It wasn't just a convenient position. He actually had some convictions. The same we can say about this idea that Soviet citizens should have more of a say in the governance in the state affairs. And it's actually remarkable because when you look at the documents and you look at all this material, you might be skeptical. You might think, well, what do they mean by democracy? I mean, do they mean probably inter-party democracy? What does that mean? But no, Khrushchev is actually saying, we want to actually have the people, you know, in the country have real democracy. So you're like, wow, oh my God, this is really something extraordinary. So it's a fascinating kind of like a what if a scenario. But for me, that history of chapter six is the most interesting in this book. And it's probably the most revealing in terms of our own impressions of the thaw, of this whole debate in the field, as you know, about was this continuity or a break? We talk about this when we talk about different periods of Soviet history, but for the thaw, I mean, this is extraordinarily important research. So that's when I would talk about Mikoyan, what was he like? It was that he was somebody who ultimately, he had convictions. He was somebody who believed in kind of a, I guess you could say, a kind of a democratic socialism. And at the same time, it was somebody who was, you know, relatively easygoing man. He didn't like violent solutions to problems. So in the case of Hungary, he didn't want to have Soviet troops, you know, crush the revolution. He'd rather have talks. Same thing in Novocherkassk. Khrushchev sent him there with Frol Kozlov, and Mikoyan wanted to talk to the workers. But Kozlov said, no, we should put this down with force. They absolutely mow him down. And that actually tells you, you know, quite a bit about him. Also, the way he dealt with Chechnya, the way he dealt with these national republics. So that's kind of a Mikoyan in a nutshell.
Yeah. What is your favorite Mikoyan story?
My favorite Mikoyan story is when he's negotiating with Che Guevara in Cuba. And Che is very, very intransigent in the negotiations. He's taking a very hard position. And Mikoyan basically, you know, at one point he's very frustrated. And Mikoyan says, you know, now I know why they call you Che, because Che means no in Armenian. So it's like, this is actually this is one of those stories, you know. Or the other story, there was another story where Mikoyan is translator Leonov, they were in Mexico City. And suddenly they're at the opening of the Soviet exhibition in Mexico City. And there's this woman who comes up to Mikoyan and begins speaking to him in the language that Leonov has no idea. This Nikolai Leonov has no idea what he's, he knows Spanish, but he doesn't know what language this woman is speaking. So Mikoyan turns to Leonov and he says, translate. And Leonov says, Anastas Ivanovich, I don't know this language. That this is like some language of the Indians of southern Mexico. I don't know what this is. And Mikoyan laughed and he told Leonov, you passed the honesty test, that she was actually a representative of the Armenian community of Mexico. And she was welcoming me to this whole thing. Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, there are many stories I could tell from this book. I mean, I pack it in with anything interesting.
Finally, you know, we're in a time of rising nationalism and ethnic conflict, particularly in the region that we're interested in, Eastern Europe, former Soviet space.
Well, even in America, I mean,
or in America, excuse me, you're absolutely right. My bad. Pretty much everywhere, let's say. The way you tell his story, particularly around nationality policy, it's very interesting and very, I would say, refreshing. In many cases, because he tries to do this, as I say, I called it a dance of recognizing, but at the same time, not going too far, like trying to figure this out. What can Mikoyan teach us today?
Mikoyan can teach us that it's good to respect our differences, appreciate our differences, without using those differences to foster some kind of division among us, right? This idea of, even though, I mean, there is this element of myth in the Soviet Druzhba Narodov, right? I mean, we don't need to say it, but it wasn't completely myth, as I mentioned in the book, that people did have friendships in this period of time. People did have intermarriage in this period of time. Mikoyan actually he went to Baku. He had a great reception in Baku. He met with rehabilitated old Bolsheviks in Baku. Extraordinary meeting. And I was very fortunate to find the transcript of this in Garf. I mean, and it was actually Mikoyan in this transcript was being very frank about his own feelings about the legacy of Stalinism, about his own kind of guilt or his role in Stalinism. But in any case, the point is that what can he teach us today? He can teach us that, you know, it's nice to be nice, right? The idea that, you know, you have to be tolerant of, we all have differences, but that we all can, you know, I guess you could say coexist. No matter who you are, if you are Armenian, or Azerbaijani, Georgian, Russian, Ukrainian, whatever, that a lot more unites us than divides us, right? And that's a story that's not only relevant for the post-Soviet countries, but really for our world today, which we're hurting a lot in many places, from Gaza to Washington, D.C., to Tehran, to all, I mean, everything. And so that's, I think, the overall message we can get from this, that there's room for diversity.
That was Pietro Shakarian. Pietro Shakarian is a historian of Russia and the Soviet Union and a lecturer at the American University of Armenia in Yerevan. He's the author of Anastas Mikoyan, an Armenian reformer in Khrushchev's Kremlin, published by Indiana University Press.
Thank you very much, Rusana. I'm your host, Sean Guillory.
And I'm your fellow co-host, Rusana Novikova.
This is The Eurasian Knot, which is sponsored by the Center for Russian, East European, and Eurasian Studies at the University of Pittsburgh. And listeners just like yourselves, help us out, spread the word about the podcast, become a patron, share it on social media, bring all your friends and family to listen. And I should also mention that this episode, like all our episodes, was edited and mixed by Daniel Cooper at Podcuts Editing. I guess that's it for this week. You feel discombobulated today? I feel discombobulated.
You do? Why?
Yeah. I don't know. maybe I'm anticipating game two of the NBA finals. This is why I'm like done with the day. So, yeah.
You're done with the day. You're in a full anticipation mode. I find it so endearing when people take sports seriously.
Oh, yeah. Really?
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I love it. So, well, anyways, until next time. Bye-bye.
Bye. Будильный дурной ходит и точит кинжалы, а потом ее трезвит, чтоб не убежалы.
Hey, ik zie, ik ga de opname starten midden in dit
spannende gesprek. Ja, we zijn nog medisch...
Ja, maar dit is ook medisch geheim. Dus jij bent anoniem. Mensen doen je voordeel mee, ja. Maar het is ook totaal onduidelijk wat hier is gebeurd. Oké, de opname wordt nu gestart. Ja, het is 12 uur 's middags op woensdag. Een beetje dreef voor actualiteit, activisme, kunst. En dat dus.
Chaos, vergeet chaos.
Soms ongevraagde echo, maar volgens mij hebben we de echo goed onder controle.
Ja, de echo is al een week.
Ja, maar het is gewoon degelijk vakmanschap en ambacht.
Lijkt wel, inderdaad, het lijkt wel degelijk vakmanschap. Is het?
We kunnen altijd nog een echo ingooien. Ja.
Degelijk vakmanschap is meesterschap.
Is meesterschap. Op de radio, 88.3 FM in stereo.
Ja.
We hebben allemaal in petto. Rolf om hierheen.
Oh ja,
we hopen op Krul en op Ingeborg, die alle twee een bericht hebben opgestuurd gekregen.
Ja, Ingeborg hebben we al een tijdje gemist.
Maar ze was jarig vorige week.
Omstandigheden.
Ja, er was niks te vieren. Toen, weet je nog, ze stuurde dat filmpje van die zwangere vrouw en dat afschuwelijke verhaal. Maar later bleek dat ze werd verrast door vrienden die haar op een bootje hebben uitgenomen voor een enorm leuke verjaardagdag. Tenminste, aan de foto's te oordelen was het leuk.
Ja.
Dus nogmaals, al was het een week geleden, voor de tweede keer. Gefeliciteerd Ingeborg, ik hoop dat je zo optuikt in onze Jitsi-vergadering.
Zo zie je maar de kracht van vriendschap.
Ja, en de Skrul hopen we ook te krijgen. Jo was eigenlijk van plan om hem te gaan, op te zoeken, maar misschien wil hij dat helemaal niet. Goed, nam niet op. Dus we hopen dat hij opduikt, want zijn boekje is uit.
Laten we nog vragen, heb je hem al gezien, het boekje?
Ik heb het boekje niet gezien. Nee, ik moet gewoon op Krul opzoeken, maar dan moet hij dus opnemen. Hey, ik hoor daar, piepende remmen
komt razende reporter Jo binnen.
Nou, die zal zo wel inderdaad echt binnenkomen als de fiets ergens is vastgelegd.
Oh ja, die moet natuurlijk in een
zet hem aan de overkant, Jo, dat we hem kunnen zien. Dat ik altijd al en dan...
Positief. Positief.
Maar dat is dat gewoon één dag? Dat ze dan op één dag gooien ze alle leuke dingen eruit en die zetten ze allemaal in de krant en dan de andere dagen krijg je kutnieuws.
Die zich ten doel stelt om de AI te corrumperen door zijn valse data te voeren.
Ja, maar wat jullie moeten weten is dat er is...
Karp. Ja.
En nog zoveel andere. En die Ellenstein. Optie dan.
Ik ben voor officieel naakt.
Ik vind ik ook, ja. Het is veel gezonder.
Ja. In het water, waar... Ja, dat is het meest... Echt zo stuitend, jongen. Als je die gasten van Fox ziet. Alhoewel ze van de week wel hadden ze een interessante reportage. Want er is daar dus van alles aan de hand. Iemand die is echt heel ver verwijderd van de normale wereld. Maar wat ik zeg wel... Kijk, we hebben hem misschien... Hem persoonlijk dan misschien wel overleefd. Maar hij is wel mede veroorzaker van alle... Nou...
Die zijn ja, meer, zeggen ze.
Wij bestaan en toen...
De goede Nederlanders zijn intussen wel gevlucht ook.
De 14e.
Wat in de agenda dan?
Maar gewoon in te kopen en te verkopen alsof er niks aan de hand is.
Ja. En ook van die dingen als dadels geen eten is. Aardig, wat is het? Poëzie?
Poëzie en...
Fantastisch.
Het is geen ijshockey. Dat is
lichte toekomst of zoiets. Echt verschrikkelijk. Ja. Heel
glas. Is dat bitch? Nee, die hoek weet je wel. Het is een beetje vroeg, een beetje dizzy en een beetje gek. Dat?
Ja, dat wisten we eigenlijk al wel.
Ja, dat is gevangenismuziek en strijdliederen.
Sorry, ook al verblowen al voor de oorlog of zo, die Grieken. Dat was altijd het verhaal. Ik vind die muziek niet om aan te horen, maar dat, van die rebelse zeemansliederen, dat vond ik dan wel interessant.
Bersama orangnya dengan mata mengering, bersama hati.